The Shema is the centerpiece of daily Jewish
morning and evening prayer services, and is considered by some the most essential prayer in all of Judaism. The Shema prayer stands as an affirmation of monotheism and the singularity God in the life of the Jewish people. It is a beautiful expression of devotion to and trust in God. Hear these words from the Shema prayer, which come from the words of Moses in Deuteronomy. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God. The Lord is one. Blessed is his name, whose glorious kingdom is forever and ever. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. These words that I command you today shall be upon your heart. Repeat them to your children and talk about them when you sit in your home and when you walk in the street, when you lie down and when you rise up. Hold fast to them as a sign upon your hand, and let them be as reminders before your eyes. Write them on the doorposts of your home and at your gates.
I would like to introduce and welcome forward Reverend Barbara Turner Delisle to introduce Tony Rindy.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It is my great honor to introduce our guest today, Tony Rindy, and welcome her to our pulpit. But before I do, I'd like to share a short story about how this came to be. It's one of those spiritual coincidence, synchronicity, divine timing kind of stories. And it centers around our member and co-leader of Annum Cara, Marge Miller. You see, the events of this month are all related to Marge's friendship with Tony, as well as her vision of building bridges between our church and others, in this case, with the Jewish faith and culture. There's a little divine comedy in this story, as well as divine timing. I had contacted Carl von Eigen, the head of our social justice team, to see if there would be enough interest in the congregation for a virtual tour of Auschwitz, something I had heard about and was interested in. And I couldn't attend the meeting that this was discussed at. And so guess what? Yeah. Guess who got elected, nominated, volunteered to lead the month of April? Yep, that's right, that's right. So the day I found out I was to head up this topic, and in an unrelated conversation with Marge, she mentioned how inspired she has been with Tony's strength and Tony's story. She says, she said Tony is an amazing speaker and has presented to groups all over the world, all over the US, about her life and the horrors of the Holocaust and more. Marge was thinking of asking Mike if Tony could come and speak to our church. And I said, go no further. You're speaking to the one. And so worlds collided. The plan was hatched. Marge spoke with Tony, introduced she and I, and we were off to the races. Not only are we blessed to have Tony here today to share her story of surviving the Holocaust, but because of this holy alliance, We will be attending Shabbat service at Tony's Synagogue, B'nai Israel, this coming Friday April 21st. And once Tony told Rabbi Joshua of our interest, he suggested we come in an hour early at 6 instead of just at 7, so that he could sit with us and talk with us and answer our questions and share about the temple, take us into the Holy of Holies, share with us the Ark and the most sacred artifact in all Judaism, the Torah, which in this case is one that also survived the Holocaust and was owned by Tony's grandfather. Yeah, so this is pretty important. So to round this all out, on April 30th, we will visit the Florida Holocaust Museum. Tony and her husband, John, who couldn't be with us today, we're going to add him to our prayers because he had a medical incident and couldn't be with us. And John is also a Holocaust survivor, and the two of them have served on the board of the Florida Holocaust Museum and had much creative input into its development. So now let me introduce Tony Rindy, a Holocaust survivor, a woman who has done much to bring awareness of the atrocities perpetuated against people of the Jewish faith and culture. I hope you have read our open door on April 6th and seen her a bio and a listing of all those boards that she has served on, all the ways that she has helped our people to learn about the Holocaust, to learn about these atrocities, and to help us understand what we have done and what we need to do. So, Tony, let me welcome you. We are so blessed to have you with us. Tony Rindy.
Good morning, everyone. So let me tell you, I got up this morning and washed my face, and I said, oh my gosh, I have to put makeup on because I have to look right in all these people. And I drove up here, and as I turned into the driveway, and your sign of shalom met my heart, my makeup fell apart. It's true. Anyway, I'm so delighted to be here to share just a little bit of my story with you this morning. I was born in Poland in a city called Przemysl, a city that had 60,000 people in it, of which 20,000 were Jewish. War broke out in September 1939, and Przemysl was divided, bisected at that point between Russia and Germany. And at that point, a Ribbentrop Pact was signed between Stalin and Hitler not to invade, to go by the lines that they had agreed on. Well, unfortunately, neither one of them were wonderful gentlemen. They sort of walked all over each other. And in a very short time, when the Russians were there, we were under Russian occupation, and when the Russians were there, we had relatively normal lives. It wasn't great. We were not starving. We were not being beaten, but we were living under a situation where you had to be careful. You had to, quote unquote, behave. You couldn't do anything that they suggested was not the right way to be. And things were okay until 1942 in June. Hitler invaded again, came through full force, and within no time established the ghetto in Przemysl. The Jews of the city were herded into the ghetto very, very quickly. You packed one suitcase if you were lucky, if you weren't lucky, you just went, you just ran. We were put behind these walls within a number of blocks, 20,000 people within several blocks. Life living became impossible. Sanitation was awful. Health was totally ignored. Life was impossible because we had food shortages right away. You couldn't get that much food into an area for that many people. Luckily, as luck would have it, my father became in charge of the food distribution in the ghetto. And at the same time, he was given the position of teaching Schwamberger. He was the commander of the ghetto, how to ride horseback. Schwamberger was an animal, to say the least. Schwamberger would take my father for rides through the city and would see a woman holding a child. He would grab the child, throw the child up, and shoot. Okay? That was Schwamberger. Schwamberger was accused of war crimes and actually put to death in Germany many, many years after the Holocaust, of course. And my dad actually was supposed to go and speak on behalf of himself as directly knowing Schwamberger, but my mother wouldn't let him go. She said, "You're not going." So they taped my father, and that was used as evidence in the trial. So my dad was in charge of food distribution and teaching Schwamberger and his wife how to ride horses. You ask why. My father's family owned a large ranch in Poland, outside of Przemyśl, where they grew wheat and food stocks, and he rode horseback. So my dad was a phenomenal horseback rider, phenomenal horseman. And of course, he was teaching Schwamberger. Things got really bad, very, very quickly. My dad was befriended by a Lieutenant Alfred Battelle, who was in charge of the Wehrmacht, the army that was controlling the ghetto at that point. And my dad came to Battelle one day and said, "You must help me. We are now the next people that are doomed for execution for being taken to Auschwitz, and that would be the end of us." Battelle was a wonderful man. Battelle got 100 people out of the ghetto at night with trucks that he commandeered to go to pull those 100 Jews out. That is a historical fact. It is written in the books. 100 Jews were saved by Battelle. So at night, we were taken out of the ghetto, and my family and myself were put into the basement of the Wehrmacht. Other people were dispersed all throughout the city. We stayed in that basement for 4 days. And I have to tell you, Battelle came to the basement every single day with a tangerine for me. He said, "Children need fruit. We have to keep her alive." Okay? After the 4 days, the entire city that was hiding, all the Jewish people were put back on the trucks, brought back into the ghetto. My dad realized that things are not going to be getting better, but certainly worse, just because it was passed by the one time that we were going to be put on trains to Auschwitz. It's going to happen again, and down the road, they're going to get us. My dad, through his father, had tremendous connections in town. My grandfather was a very well-liked person, and there were an awful lot of people that would do many things to help us. We had a connection to a couple of the people that worked for my grandfather. They came at night with a horse and buggy, hay on the bottom, in this big wagon. One by one, my mother, my grandfather who was with us there, myself, and later on my dad, were taken out of the ghetto at night, brought to a local farm in town. Things weren't great because in those days, if you helped a Jew, you were killed. There was no discussion. You were shot, you were hanged, you were brutally tortured. Whatever needed to be done, it was taken care of. And not only that, but you were made a spectacle in the city. You were left hanging on a gallows for everyone else to see that if you help a Jew, that's what's going to happen to you. Well, unfortunately, that farmer that helped us, that had us hidden in his barn for several weeks, was killed. He was hung in town. He was first beaten and then hung in town with his wife in the town square to again show people this is what happens to you if you help the Jews. We were hidden in between the barn and the basement in his house for about a month. Things got out in the public that this gentleman, this farmer, was helping Jews, and that's when they killed him. One of his co-workers that worked on the farm with him came to church one Sunday morning, and she got drunk and spread the word around, we have to get rid of him because he's got Jews living in his basement. Okay? So needless to say, the next day, what happened? So at night, we left this one barn, this one farmer, and went to another family. And again, this family helped us tremendously. They fed us. As a matter of fact, not that long ago, the Holocaust Museum found the young kid that was alive in those days, the son of the farmer. I called him to Poland, and he was a little older than I was, and he said to me he remembers his mother carrying me in her arms in order to try to feed me when things got really bad. But they killed the parents, again, because Jews were being hidden in their facility. I became very sick. I was probably 2 years old at that point, maybe two and a half, two, closer to two. And I became sick, and you can't hide with a child. A child lets themselves be known, right? Whether good or whether bad, you know when there's a child around. I became sick, and my parents had to make some very serious, heavy decisions. They made the decision to give me away. Through the Catholic Archdiocese, which Przemysl was the seat, they found a wonderful lady who would take me and keep me as her niece. Okay? My name had to be changed. My birth certificate had to be changed. I had to learn catechism. I had to go to church every single day, and I prayed. And this wonderful lady said to me that if ever you were questioned by anyone and they ask about you, I was her niece, right? And where were your parents? Your parents were sent to another city to work for the German effort. Okay, well, tell that to 2.5-year-old little child, okay? You know, all they had to do was come and give me a candy. I will tell you whatever you want to know. And I will repeat it if you have any questions. So, I was not allowed to come into the main room of the house. I had to stay in my bedroom all the time, especially if someone came to the door. I was not allowed to be in the room. They were afraid. They were afraid because children talk, whether they want to or they don't. A person can get all the facts and information speaking to a child. Life was not easy for me. The only good thing is that I had a wonderful lady that took care of me. I addressed her as my aunt. Her name was Konyosna, and she was my aunt Konyosna. My parents went back to where they were hiding. And after a while, they had to leave because, again, too much threat was happening to the family that was hiding them. My parents went to the woods and stayed in a partisan community for close to 2 years. The war was not easy. Do I remember? Yes, I do. when something traumatic happens to you, even though you may be 3 and 3.5 years old, there's memory there. Whether it's brought up every day of your life, no. But when things start coming back and you start having conversations, you remember. My mother always used to say, how do you remember all these things? I can't believe that. I didn't remember, and you remember? And I said, yes, I remember. And she was amazed at the fact that I was telling her what was going on. Long story short, I stayed with this wonderful lady for close to 3 years. She took care of me. She fed me to the best of her ability. Food was always a problem, but she was a wonderful lady. My parents had a very difficult time. They were in the woods. My grandfather, elderly gentleman, finally died. My father and my uncle buried him in the woods and marked the spot with a stick or stone or whatever in order to be able to find him, find his body after the war, when things were able to become sort of normal. And they did. They exhumed his body after the war, and they buried him in the Jewish cemetery in Poland. So things were not easy. Life was very difficult. Being a Jew was the worst thing you could be. You know, my dad was addressed by this Schwamberger who he was teaching horseback riding. You dirty Jew, you Jew pig. That's how he addressed him every single day. His wife, on the other hand, was a delightful lady and would bring my dad pieces of food that she was able to put into her pockets, into her jacket, wherever, and she would give him something to eat. Things settled down. The war was over. Very few people were alive. Shemesh, with a population of 20,000 Jewish people before the war, probably had about 9 when we went back to our community. They were killed, they were slaughtered, they were murdered, they were burned. Any atrocity that you could possibly visualize is what happened. My parents came back to get me. Well, I looked at these two people and who are you? I don't know you. I don't want to go to you. I don't want to have any part of you. I love my aunt. She's been taking care of me, and why are you taking me away? Why are you even making those noises? I won't go. It's not easy dealing with me, even at that age. So my parents hired this young girl that moved into an apartment with them, and hoping to entice me, because I was, at that point, 4.5, and a young girl was great. I mean, I had somebody that I could play with, right? Well, it didn't work that fast. It took 3 months for my parents to finally get me to go with them, and that wasn't easy either, because I said, well, yeah, okay, we'll go, I'll come stay with you. It didn't happen that fast. But finally, my parents put their foot down and said, this is ridiculous, okay? We've got to get our lives together. We moved from Przemysl to Katowice, which is another city northwest of Przemysl. My dad became in charge of the Jewish community in order to help orphans that were created because of the Holocaust. He was writing false birth certificates to the land of Palestine for these children. The Polish people got wind of that, and there was a note put on our door, if you do not leave within 24 hours, you and your family will be killed. This was after the war, after the Holocaust, okay? So anti-Semitism doesn't go away on a set date. It's here to stay alive and well, as we all know right now. We went from Katowice, we went to Prague. My mother became very ill. She was hospitalized. The doctor that was taking care of her was a Jewish lady, and she was wonderful. Besides getting my mother back on her feet, she asked us to come live with her in her home, which we did. And that lasted for about 3 months, because we were waiting to see where a quota would open to come to the United States. So we moved into her house about 3.5 months, and my dad got wind that there's a quota opening in Paris. We left her home in Prague. We went to Paris. My dad reports to whoever you reported to in those days, and they said, oh, that line starts all the way back there. Get in line. So by the time our number came up, it was closed. Okay? So there we were in Paris. What do you do? A family, a child? Well, you try to find work, you try to find some semblance of reality. So we lived in Paris for about a year. I never went to school because my parents were always concerned about sending me to school. Sending me any place out of their reach was just not the thing to do. After Paris, we went to Holland, to Amsterdam, because again, we heard that a quota was opening. And yes, the quota opened. We came to this country. My uncle met us at the docks, and here we are. He was a man who was a physician that was caught right before the war started at a medical conference in New York. Telegraphed back to his parents, what should I do? And they said to him, do not come back. And that was the last time, of course, that he saw his parents. But the good thing is, he was very helpful to us. He helped us get settled. We had an apartment waiting for us. And then I started school, right? I was 7 years old at that point. No education, no language. I didn't read. I didn't write. What do we do? My dad was afraid to send me to a public school because he was concerned there would be no Jewish people there. And he was afraid to send me to someplace without Jews around. So I went to a day school, a Hebrew English school. I was 7. I was put into kindergarten. And kids, they can be very, very cruel, very cruel. And you know what? They were. I didn't look the same. My hair wasn't the same. I didn't dress the same. And worst of all, I didn't speak the language. And I didn't read and write. But it wasn't so bad. In that 1 year, I went from kindergarten to first grade to second grade. At the end of the year, I received an award as being the top Hebrew student in the school. Okay, so I learned English, I learned Hebrew, and it worked. My dad came here under an agricultural quota, which meant that he had to go settle, or we had to go settle on a farm, which is what we did. We moved from New York. We moved to Vineland, New Jersey, which is South Jersey, where a lot of the newcomers that came to this country moved to. I went to school there, made very good friends with a girl that lived not too far away from us. We, you know, we were living in the country in a home that was a farmhouse. I made friends with this girl that didn't live too far away from me. We took the school bus together. I went to Decatur Avenue, which was the public school, and she went to a Catholic school right across the street. And everything was great and wonderful. And one day, we're walking to school where the school bus dropped us off, and she turns around to me and says, Jews, pew, they stink. Well, I didn't know what that meant. I had never had that kind of a situation occur. You see, I didn't know that I was a Jew and that I was supposed to have died in the Holocaust. I had no idea. My parents never said anything to me because why? Number one. Number two, how do you start explaining to a 7 or 8 year old child that I am hated for what? For being Jewish? How do you explain that? How do you explain hate to a child? Before even saying religion, how do you explain hate? You don't explain hate because we hope nobody ever knows that word. But my dad said, okay, you're through with the public school. Now you're going back to a day school, a Hebrew English school again. We lived in Estelle Manor. My day school was in Atlantic City, okay? Probably about 40 miles from where we lived. So you know, you hear these stories, oh yeah, I walked 20 miles in the snow and what have you. Well, let me tell you about my trips to back and forth from school. My dad took me from our house to a town called Mays Landing. At 8 o'clock in the morning, the bus in Mays Landing came, a city bus, that took me 40 minutes to get to Atlantic City. I was dropped off at the bus station, and in Atlantic City, I took a little it was called a jitney, like a little car, little van that drove me to my school, at the corner, of course, dropped me off, and I walked. So the entire process took 2 hours, in the morning and in the evening. No snow, I don't think, but 2 hours. In the summertime or spring, where days were longer, that was not a problem. But in the wintertime, when it gets dark at 5 o'clock, and I wouldn't get to back home from school to the point where my dad was picking me up was until six. What do you do? It's dark. I was scared. But you know what? My dad told me you have to stand at this one corner and I will be there. Well, that's all great. However, there's traffic and things happen. And my dad wasn't always there. He couldn't make it on time. So I stood at the corner. But anyway, things were okay. Things were all right. I went from the day school again in Atlantic City. I said to my dad, I can't do this anymore. I have to go to a public school. I need friends. I need people. I have to be around people. So I changed. We went from the day school in Atlantic City to a regular grammar school in Pleasantville, which was about 10 miles away. I went to Pleasantville School, grammar school. I graduated, and I did fine, okay? I graduated all the public school education, and then I needed to go to high school, okay? I went to high school to Vineland, New Jersey, Vineland High, again, about 25 miles from where I lived. So how do you make friends when they're 25 miles away? How do you have any social contact when it's 25 miles away? You know what? You do what has to be done. My dad drove me. Sometimes my friends would come over. Other parents drove. It was okay. It was much, much better than I had in the past. So things were fine. Things were good. I went to high school. I graduated. I went to Drexel University in Philadelphia. I was pre-med, but I met this young man who I married, and the pre-med sort of went down the drain. I became a medical technologist. I did research in hematology, and I worked because that's what you do, right? Mm-hmm. You get out there and you work, and things were great, and I'm going to make this very short. Met my husband, we got married. John was an engineer. He was an MIT graduate with 3 degrees out of MIT, and down the road decided to go to medical school. Okay? So what do? I went back to work. I'm a hematology research person, so I got a job at the clinical lab and then went into the university hematology research department, and everything was great. He graduated medical school finally after 7 years, and we moved to Clearwater, Florida, Largo, Florida. And today I'm speaking to this wonderful congregation of people. So all I can tell you is he's wonderful. He is so amazing. Not my husband's wonderful too, but right now, this is it. And I so appreciate the wonderful, warm welcome that I've gotten from everybody here. You're an amazing congregation, amazing people. Having you come to our temple Friday night is going to be fabulous. I spoke to the rabbi about it, and we discussed a number of things. I unfortunately will not be there if everything is okay with my husband. We have a family bar mitzvah in New York. So, can't do it. But the Torah that is in that ark is a Torah that survived the Holocaust. My grandfather was financially pretty comfortable, so he built a synagogue on his property for people that were not able to go to the city to afford the trip to the city. So he built a synagogue, and that Torah was handwritten for that synagogue. And today it stands in Clearwater, Florida. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
that was powerful. My goodness. We're going to need a moment of just pausing, I think, to take in that story. Wow. Thank you for coming here and sharing your story with us. We want to present you with something from the congregation. This is a check. We try and do local benevolences to organizations doing phenomenal work. So we want to present a check on behalf of Faith UCC to the Florida Holocaust Museum in your honor, Tony.
Thank you so much.
It's gratitude for your presence here today.
So my makeup ran already, so there's not much left. Thank you. Thank you. What a generous, wonderful, wonderful gesture. And please know the museum will certainly appreciate it. And I will hand that to them. What's tomorrow? Tomorrow's Monday? Tomorrow. I'm not wasting any time. I will take a ride. Thank you again for your hospitality and your understanding.
Thank you so much.